Today's volume of trading, 10,503,000 shares. Industrials are up 10.81 to 851.40. Rails, 188.74, up 1.45.
That was part of it. Battery-powered toothbrushes and more trips to Europe than ever before. Office boys investing in utilities and Chilean nitrate. You could pick up the Wall Street Journal in the barbershop.
We are in the midst of the greatest upward surge of economic well-being in the history of any nation. Our flourishing progress...
More people ate more and more lavishly, took more baths, and bought more new cars than ever in human history. There was a waiting list for Cadillacs. At the Arthur Discotheque in New York, Scotch whiskey went for $1.70 an ounce. They plan to open a bunny club on the island of Guam.
Ford, 51.5. AT&T closed at 66.25. Eastern Airlines, 52.125. RCA, 33.25.
The music was confident, loud, and assertive, and disquieting somehow, as though specially written to keep time with all our ills.
God damn it, I hate to put bombs and napalm on these people, and on these women and children. I just didn't do it. I just couldn't.
This man is an American colonel in Vietnam. He was wounded in the leg when the Viet Cong fired on his helicopter. The leg will have to be amputated. They haven't told him yet, but he guesses.
I got a lot of pain in that left ankle. That's a good sign. It's that sharp pain that you get when you got nerves, you know. It's that sharp nerve pain. Burning.
They do all they can to save that leg.
I know.
Conscience objection should not be just limited to religious grounds. Political grounds should be included. As you know, the Nuremberg laws, which the United
States
ratified...
Two men, strangers to each other, and separated by thousands of miles.
...for his conduct, and that neither fear, nor ignorance, nor orders, were any excuse
two men,
for crimes against
each
humanity.
Striving to do what he thinks is right. Each grappling to find his way in a world where the old truths were being challenged, and the new truths were not yet known.
Is our world gone? We say farewell. Is a new world coming?
I personally am for any college health service giving out pills if the girls are 21, even if they do.
This girl is a college student. She is talking about birth control pills. She is neither afraid of the subject nor embarrassed. It was a part of the change. It was a year of many changes.
Today, the world is facing a population crisis, in my judgment, greater in scope, more serious in effect than anything Malthus dreamed possible. One half of the world's population and two-thirds of the world's children do not have enough to eat today.
By the late 1970s, our requirements for fresh water will overtake our supply.
Maybe the bitter irony of the century that as the doctors prolong our productive lives, the same science of which they're part cuts down the time at which a person is permitted to enjoy it.
Only birth control on a massive scale, coupled with rapidly increased food production in the developing countries, can prevent the greatest worldwide catastrophe of modern times.
The change was fast and insistent. It was a year when protest became not only fashionable, but almost a full-time profession. It was the young, mainly. Both sexes dressed alike, chinos and sweaters, long hair on the boys and frequently beards. Sometimes the beard helped in telling boys from girls. They played guitars and walked in protest marches and listened to Bach on hi-fi and sometimes to Bob Dylan. And they had a name, the New Left.
I don't always agree with what people call the New Left. But the main issue here is not what I believe, you know, outside of the Vietnam movement. There are people, all kinds of people involved in the Vietnam movement, some of whom were very militantly...
He was not alone in his thinking. It became a kind of debate. Which side are you on? Do you support the war in Vietnam or oppose it? And it was almost like asking how old you are.
Stand or fall because of the people in the peace movement. Nobody manipulates them. And then I would, you know...
A lot of these students are college students, and right now they're acting like a bunch of immature kids. Everybody have an obligation. I mean, One man shouldn't have to come over here.
Always follow our conscience. We should think much more in terms of one world rather than of one's country. Laws that are just laws, they're laws that are for the common good.
Our first reaction was one of utter revulsion to the protests against the stand that our government has taken. I feel that we have to stand behind our president when the decision is made, and this is a point
I submit that if you really want to achieve in Asia what the spokesman for our government says they want to achieve, you must be ready to go to war with China, with all that implies.
The Eastern world, it is exploding. Violence flaring and bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again,
the eve of destruction. This and another song, Where Have All the Flowers Gone, were among a rash of 1965 popular songs protesting the Vietnam War. Songs written by folk singers like Dylan and Joan Baez, who in an earlier year had produced lyrics of protest on civil rights. The songs were musical manifestations of a loud and widespread dissent that clearly had its beginnings in those civil rights movements. It was loudest and most active on the college campuses, and it was echoed throughout the ranks of the nation's intelligentsia. Some ardent protesters publicly burned their draft cards, and two conscientious objectors burned themselves to death, one near the Pentagon, the other outside United Nations headquarters. But with all the noise and fury and sometimes horror of the Vietnam dissent, President Johnson clung to a substantial nationwide consensus of support, although everywhere there were doubts.
Not long ago, most Americans didn't know where Vietnam was or care. In 1965, they did know and did care. Since it was French for 100 years, Saigon has some of the sound and feel and atmosphere of Paris, or would if there hadn't been a war on, but the American Marines there didn't think they were in Paris. Instead, they were in the reality of heat and bombing runs and nights in those little villages where they could hear the Viet Cong only a few yards away. We have entered most of our wars with solemnity and high purpose. It didn't happen that way in Vietnam. The war didn't start, it evolved, or to use the current word, escalated. When the French pulled out, we sent some military people to Saigon. The purpose was to give advice and moral support to the South Vietnamese government, which was fighting the encroachments of the communists to the north. In 1960, a total of 785 military advisors were in the country. Sometimes they got close enough to the actual fighting to see it. The day came when they were shot at. By 1961, there were 2,000 American soldiers in the country. The name had changed from military advisors to combat support units. In 1962, there were 11,000. 1963, it was 16,500. By August 1965, there were 90,000 American soldiers in Vietnam, and more than twice that number by year's end. They weren't there primarily to advise or support anybody. They were fighting a war. The escalation in 1965 began in February, when the Viet Cong blew up a United States Army barracks, killing 22 GIs. We retaliated by sending jet planes to bomb military targets in North Vietnam. Except for one brief hiatus, the bombing attacks continued through the year to Christmas Eve. At the same time, American combat units began arriving by the thousands. And by year's end, more than 1,500 American soldiers had been killed in the fighting, 1,300 of them in 1965 alone.
Roger, rounds complete.
Bob Hope, who'd been in almost as many campaigns as Stonewall Jackson, dropped in to make it official.
Thank you. Yes, sir. Thank you. Thrilled to be here in Sacramento. Thank you very much. Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, here we are in Saigon. That's Vietnamese for I must be nuts. You all know Saigon. It's a booby trap of the mayor. Please, we don't want too much applause. I'd hate to be held over here. No, I just want to say that here I am, the longest delivery that Chicken Delight ever made. I forgot to burn my draft card, and here I am. And you men have a very important mission, to make the world safe for our pickets. I want to tell you, I had to come back, though. My malaria was homesick. I'm happy to be here. I understand everything's great. The situation's improved. In fact, things couldn't be better. Well, who am I going to believe, you or Huntley and Brinkley?
Well, Mr. Hope was of a generation that could point out Attu on the map and Guam and remember jokes about Lucky Strike Green. The new professors didn't, and they were not amused by Bob Hope or anyone else.
Actually, there's 14 different ways to beat the draft as such. One was, number one was be a CO, number two, have a demonstration, number three, refuse to sign the loyalty oath, number four was play at being a homosexual, number five, you can get a note from a friendly family doctor, you know, if you can afford to buy one or if you happen to have one handy, getting a note from you.
As chaplain here, I have seen many men go down. I've conducted memorial services for them. Many times the question comes, is this vain or is this a waste? Relatives often write and wonder if this isn't a ridiculous war we're in.
And at home, the stocks went up and people got married or went on vacation or on strike, but it wasn't quite the same. Many of the old familiar things were suddenly becoming quaint and not to be taken seriously anymore. Can you remember at least two movies in which the Andrews sisters sang on the deck of an aircraft carrier? Well, the word for that was camp. The word is hard to define, but basically it was anything so ridiculous it was amusing. Tiffany lampshades, Ruby Keeler musicals, old copies of Batman comics, Claire piano rolls.
Suddenly that year, familiar things, sometimes familiar voices, were challenged. Princess Margaret came for a visit and made a statement prepared by whoever prepares such things for the use of royalty. The new ones couldn't have cared less.
We look forward with great pleasure to meeting the President and Mrs. Johnson again, and to spending as much time as possible as we can seeing the art treasures and historic buildings that up to now we have only been able to read about.
Brigitte Bardot came, too. Like Princess Margaret, she was followed around by newsmen and she wore some dramatic clothes, but in all honesty, the whole scene was absurd.
Today, when I saw Gemini arriving in the sea, I was so full of emotion, you know. And if I have a wish to do, I'd like to meet them.
Miss Bardot did not meet the astronauts. She met a lot of reporters and press agents and Hollywood people, but most others are busy. There was a crusade, or roundup, for a better world. And the call to colors, when it came in rolling Texas style.
Our basic task is threefold. First, to keep our economy growing. to open for all Americans the opportunity that is now enjoyed by most Americans, and to improve the quality of life for all.
Lyndon Baines Johnson and the Great Society. 2 weeks before he took the oath of office for the first term as president in his own right, Mr. Johnson spelled out to Congress what he wanted for the Great Society.
Major recommendations in the three main.
The 89th Congress, with top-heavy Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate, almost immediately went to work. They were in session till 12:50 in the morning of October 23rd. In that time, they enacted and sent to President Johnson 85% of the Democratic Party's platform promises. On March 3rd, they authorized $1.1 billion to fight poverty in the Appalachians. On April 11th, they provided federal assistance for elementary and secondary schools. On June 21st, they reduced excise taxes by $4.6 billion. And 9 days later, they passed the controversial Medicare plan. On August 6th, they passed a bill ensuring Negroes the right to register and vote. And so it went. When it was all over, a record of 225 public laws had been enacted in 9 months, 18 days, and nearly 13 hours. Senate Republican leader Everett M. Dirksen made a rather plaintive comment on the session. It was an echo, he said, not a choice.
I propose that we launch a national effort to make the American city a better and a more stimulating place to live.
There is a section of Los Angeles called Watts. It is almost entirely Negro. It is a slum, but not in the eastern sense of tall, decayed buildings and narrow, littered streets. The streets in Watts are fairly broad and occasionally even lined with trees, but it's a dreary place. Checks cashed at a discount, cheap wine for sale, garbage piled up in front of stores. It's ugly, and for those who lived there in 1965, there was nowhere else to go.
Just before dark on Wednesday, August 11th, a minor incident, an apparently routine traffic arrest, turned the steaming, throbbing ghetto of Watts into a no-man's land, or rather, a no-white man's land. A rumor spread that a policeman had beaten up an old Negro woman in a dispute that followed the arrest. That was the start of 4 days and nights of rioting, looting, burning, and shooting. Rampaging mobs of Negroes running wild through a 50-square-mile area, screaming their defiance at outnumbered squads of police. By Friday, Police Chief William Parker asked help from the National Guard. They arrived and set up a command post in a high school.
After seeing some of my men an attempt to murder them with an automobile, and one man came very close to being killed, my order went out, my weapons are loaded, and they have been loaded ever since. And some people have been hurt because my weapons are loaded, and this was perfectly right, and it had to be. It was forced on us.
It was mainly over by Sunday night, and the result could be counted. 35 people killed, 926 seriously wounded, 4,289 arrested, 744 buildings damaged or destroyed by fire, 457 picked bare by looters. But if the violence ended, the anger did not.
I'm opposed to wrong in any shape, form, or fashion. I am opposed to lawlessness. I'm opposed to violence. I'm opposed to burning anything up. You don't go and burn down a house to get some rats out of it.
The anger lingered, but it was almost as if this were the climax, the end gesture in a series of gestures. We had heard these voices before in other years. Now there seemed to be a softening. The words were the same. In victory, they walked from Selma to Montgomery. It is easier to hate when you lose than when you win. And at the Alabama State Capitol in Montgomery, the new mood showed.
They told us we wouldn't get here. There were those who said that we would get here only over their dead bodies.
Well, talk.
But all the world today knows that we are here and we are standing before the forces of power in the state of Alabama saying we ain't going to let nobody turn us around.
I do not believe that the Great Society is the ordered, changeless, and sterile battalion of the ants. It is the excitement of becoming, always becoming, trying, probing, falling, resting, and trying again. But always trying and always gaining.
In the autumn of 1965, the first Roman Catholic ecumenical council in nearly a century came to an end. It was the last of four sessions that had extended across 4 years. The last session was by far the most productive. Basically, there were 11 documents on the agenda. Religious liberty, which included a section condemning anti-Semitism. A declaration on the church in the modern world. A sweeping document which ranged from family life to the morality of modern warfare. And agreements on divine revelations, the lay apostate. And on it went in sessions that were orderly and restrained, but occasionally became heated with debate and spiced with dissension. Out of the welter of words, of agreements, and debate, one fact emerged clearly. The Roman Catholic Church had moved, ponderously, perhaps as befits its size, to an adjustment with the modern world.
There was some other information to be remembered and filed away. Nikita Khrushchev was paid a pension of $330 a month. A lot of people in a lot of places who didn't like Americans threw bricks through the windows of the USIA libraries. General Motors announced a profit for the previous year of $1,735,000,000. And on April 27th, Edward R. Murrow died of cancer in Pawling, New York. A few days later, Linda Darnell died, heroically, in a house on fire. She was 43. There was Malcolm X and King Farouk, Quentin Reynolds, Jeanette MacDonald, Albert Schweitzer, Judy Holliday, Nat King Cole, and on July 14th in London, Adlai Stevenson. It's still too early to assess his impact on our times, but he surely was destined never to win completely and never completely to lose. And it is part of the Stevenson paradox that though he spoke often of peace, we remember him most vividly in a time of anger.
All right, sir. Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation, yes or no.
Sir, will you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
And while the year was still new, Sir Winston Churchill. They say that he had planned his funeral, or part of it at least. If so, he did it well. Those competent to say pointed out that not since the Duke of Marlborough had an Englishman been laid to rest with such splendor. It is not diminishing to say that Sir Winston would have approved, understood, and enjoyed every moment of it.
And now it is upon us, led by the bearer party of the guards, flanked by its escort of the Royal Air Force, the gun carriage bearing the coffin, draped with the Union Jack. On it, the gold and enamel of the insignia of the Garter. And as its breast, the slight rise, the naval crew that draws it presents an overwhelming impression of strength and solidarity. 92 broad sailors on the lead ropes, 42 steadying at the rear. And this moving mass of men, eight abreast, at their short, measured pace, the square of their formation seems to say, it's all right, we've got it. Never in that long and adventurous life was he in steadier hands.
The climax was at St. Paul's Cathedral. Here, before the kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers of the world, came his final gesture. There was a song played that was not English at all. It was American, like his mother. And for a moment, their history and our history were the same.
This was the sound of a Gemini Titan rocket lifting off from its pad at Cape Kennedy. It was probably the most dramatic sound of 1965. But there was another sound, less compelling, but possibly even more significant.
It was the sound of water being wasted. A dripping faucet can be annoying, especially in the middle of the night. But what used to be a minor irritation was seen in 1965 as a major disaster. There simply wasn't enough water.
By the late 1970s, our requirements for fresh water will overtake our supply. At the present time, we use about 355 billion gallons of water per day. The technically available supply, available in the sense that it's where you need it, when you need it, is about 550 billion gallons of water per day. By 1980, the demand will exceed that supply, and by the year 2000, only 35 years away, we will need over 1,000 billion gallons of water per day, and the supply will be the same.
The villains were the westerlies, those high-altitude winds that blow roughly from southwest to northeast and bring rain to the heartlands, to Kansas and Missouri and Michigan and the rocky little farms of New England. In 1961, these westerlies began to shift subtly to the north. The movement continued until, by 1965, they were about 500 miles off course, and there was a parched area that stretched from Maryland to Maine. Government engineers drew up plans for pumping water from one place to another, but it was clear that these were stopgap measures. There simply wasn't enough water, and if all the leaking faucets in the country were repaired, there still wouldn't be enough.
On Saturday, September 4th, Hurricane Betsy, newly born and vicious, moved to within 360 miles of Cape Kennedy. Indications were it would go north and lose itself in the North Atlantic. Indications were wrong. The next day, it headed south and hit Nassau. Miami was next, and then New Orleans. When Betsy finally drifted away and quietly expired, she left behind 100 dead and $1 billion damage. The Weather Bureau, in an uncharacteristic and somewhat sentimental gesture, announced it would retire the name Betsy for 10 years. This, they said, was because of her infamy.
A human whirlwind of sorts stunned the sports world and provided 1965's only true sports hero complete with triumph over adversity. Sandy Koufax, a lean, intensive, left-handed pitcher, dominated baseball, pitching a perfect game in September, establishing a major league record for strikeouts later that month, then almost single-handedly leading the Los Angeles Dodgers to a seventh-game victory over Minnesota in the World Series. This, despite a painful arthritic condition in Koufax's powerful pitching arm.
In Houston, they painted the ceiling of the Astrodome an off-white so outfielders could spot the pop flies. Professional football got even bigger with the Green Bay Packers, the best of the lot. And Cassius Clay, who beat Sonny Liston again, and Floyd Patterson, said afterward just about what you'd expect him to say.
I'm trying to get them to legalize it where, and sanctionize it and authorize it where I can fight about three men in one night. Because no one man really, now laying all jokes aside, no one man on earth is even fast enough to catch me. He's not fast enough to hit me. There's just nobody around. Floyd was the fastest next to me, and I played, beat him at will. You don't have a man in the world today to give me a show.
And Casey Stengel, unyielding and incomprehensible still, retired from baseball and in a sudden gesture gave his uniform with the venerable number 37, humbling New York Mets.
There is the uniform 37, and you're going to receive it for the club, whether it's going to be in your behalf or the club's behalf. I certainly want to thank you for the years of service I've had under your leadership.
There were more books that year with more four-letter words than ever before. But a lot of people were buying books with polysyllabic words. Samuel Eliot Morrison's The Oxford History of the American People was important and probably memorable. And a number of writers, of course, were concerned, as always, with the South and the Civil War, toiling, as somebody said, in the fields of Catton. Bruce Catton, by the way, made his contribution with Never Call Retreat.
It was not a memorable year for the theater. There were plenty of comedies and musicals, but no serious play survived the Broadway season. There was one development that deserves at least a footnote, I suppose, in our history. Burlesque, banned in New York City since LaGuardia, made a comeback. This incident in the cultural revival of our times brought a comment from a young lady, a frequent performer in burlesque whose name, she insists, is Tempest Storm.
My work is very artistic. When I'm on stage, I belong to the public. I never take my work home with me.
There was another exotic dancer this year who performed one night for a number of policemen who were celebrating, if memory serves, the retirement of one of their members. There was an unfortunate development, and the young lady spoke to newsmen about it more in sorrow than anger.
I had a girlfriend along with me who happens to be an exceptional oriental dancer, better known as a belly dancer. We went back to the dressing room to get dressed, and we discovered that her pants were missing, and $20 was taken from me. As far as the money is concerned, it hasn't been returned, nor the pants.
And then, on the clear, moonlit evening of November 9th, just after nightfall, the impossible happened.
Virtually all of New York City was blacked out at 5:28 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight by a power failure. Reports indicated that parts of Westchester and Eastern New York State were also affected.
Westchester, New York, Albany, New York, Binghamton, New York, and from Providence, Rhode Island. All of New York State appeared to be out of power. Robert Jenna, the president of the
port in New York City, the Transit Authority, says as many as 150,000 persons might be stranded in the city's subways.
It was as though suddenly the 20th century had been repealed.
Planes in the air were unable to land, and those on the ground were unable to take off. Travel
there were farmers who, for the first time in their lives, milked a cow by hand. Kerosene lamps lost their quaintness and were put back to work.
States where the lights went off included New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut.
On New York's Park Avenue, hostesses in Dior dresses cooked dinner in the fireplace.
Motionless without electric power in the stations and in Times Square.
Television sets blinked off, and news-hungry adults took the transistor radios away from teenagers whose rock and roll music had been replaced by blackout bulletins.
Maybe one just south of Niagara in upstate New York. There was a sudden, instantaneous power cutoff, or possibly a power surge.
For the record, the trouble was caused by a relay in a Canadian power plant 4 miles north of Niagara Falls.
Greetings to you, America. The first fall to set foot upon your land blesses you with all his heart.
It was October 4th, shortly after 9:30 in the morning. Pope Paul VI had just arrived in New York on a historic flight from Rome.
He planted the cross of Christ in his blessed soil. May this the cross of blessing, which we now trace over your skies and your land, preserve those gifts which Christ gave you and guaranteed to you: peace, comfort, freedom, justice, and above all, the vision of life in the hope of immortality. God bless this land of yours.
It is probably safe to say that never before was one single man seen in one single day by so many people.
There were 630,000 people who saw him as his car moved through Queens to Manhattan. On Third Avenue, there were signs greeting him in Italian and Spanish. He saw Harlem briefly and the towers of Fifth Avenue. At St. Patrick's Cathedral, 165,000 people awaited his arrival.
Walking down the center aisle, giving his blessing to the 5,000 assembled here, all standing, of course, is Pope Paul VI. As the organ plays the paper march, Silver Trumpets by Viviani. With both hands, His Holiness is giving his blessing. An applause wells from this huge hall on all sides, echoing from its 112 feet height.
It was not a state visit to the United States, but there was a brief meeting with President Johnson and Vice President Humphrey at the Waldorf Astoria. At 3 p.m., he left Cardinal Spellman's residence for his visit to the United Nations.
Jamais plus les uns contre les autres. Jamais plus jamais.
Not the ones against the others. Never again. Never more. The Pontiff's voice rose to stress the urgency of his message.
Jamais plus la guerre, jamais plus la guerre. C'est la paix qui doit
And again, his words were measured. No more war. War never again. Peace.
At about 8:30, the Pope, not yet showing the sign of fatigue that came later, arrived at Yankee Stadium. As one enthusiastic announcer put it, he is standing on second base. Nearly 100,000 people jammed the stadium for the papal mass.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Christ, have mercy.
Christ, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy.
Lord, have mercy. Dominus vobiscum.
There was a final visit at the Vatican Pavilion at the World's Fair. And then, at 11:30 p.m., he was airborne again. The pilot flew up the river so that the Pope could see the lights of the city, and then banked around and headed for Rome. The pilot, by the way, was a Presbyterian.
Other events in other lands made their marks on 1965's history. The communist Chinese exploded their second atomic bomb and bragged about it. Fidel Castro, for reasons not clear, relaxed his ban and allowed Cubans who wished to migrate to the United States. The very young and the very old had priority. Draft-age males were not included.
In the Atlantic Ocean on November 13th, the cruise ship Yarmouth Castle caught fire and sank with a loss of 89 lives. On December 19th, Charles de Gaulle won a runoff election to a second 7-year term as President of France. But only when he abandoned his aloof austerity and took to television after his failure to gain an absolute majority in the earlier presidential elections.
India and Pakistan fought an ugly little war in the north. On November 11th, a white minority government of Britain's African colony, Rhodesia, in a document that sounded like the American Declaration of Independence, proclaimed itself an independent nation. Expectedly, in these times, the issue was racial. And on April 24th, violence came to the Dominican Republic. It's a small country, 3 million people, but its troubles have been bigger than the country. The 30-year reign of dictator Rafael Trujillo didn't help at all, and very few Americans were disturbed when he was assassinated in 1961. Chaos followed, as it usually does when a dictator is killed, and in April, a military coup knocked over the civilian government. On the 27th, about 1,000 Americans were evacuated, and the next day, President Johnson ordered American troops in to protect, he said, the Americans still there. Other Latin American governments sent troops, and it was explained that the operation was primarily one of containment, specifically to contain the communists. It was an odd war in an odd country, but to the Marines there, it was just like any other war that any of us can remember.
I'll see you yet, Sergeant.
What have they got down there, Sergeant?
How many men have been hit?
Two.
One may be dead. I don't know. He dropped off.
Get out of.
How many men are down there?
I don't know.
There's a patrol coming back.
About 600.
And they got him.
All of them are evacuated out of here?
What?
You want him evacuated out of here?
I'll take care of him.
Huh?
Oh, hell no.
Do you have a vehicle to get him out of here?
Hey, look, they're going to need some more goddamn help.
Get him
down there. Hey!
How many men are down there, Sergeant? There's a patrol down there.
Hey, Sergeant Harrison, get some help down there for that Kelly's pin down there, too.
All they got to do is get on the phone. We can't move from here.
Well, goddamn it, get somebody on the phone then. There's about 8 men pinned down there.
Platoon down there?
Oh, where's this
driver? No, we don't have. They had a couple people down there. And they got shot. Yeah, he's out. He's out. He's dead.
Spacecraft. Tom Stafford advises in the calmest voice I think we've ever heard that they are 120 feet apart, and let's try to get some additional conversation from them.
6 and 7 Hawaii will be standing by if you have anything for them. Roger.
The date was December 15th, and four United States astronauts hurtling at 17,500 miles an hour above the Earth were pulling off the most exciting American achievement of the space race.
Separates the plane from the booster, right?
Affirmative.
That's exactly where you have one, too. It really tilted around there when you were firing your thrusters.
Command pilot Walter Schirra of Gemini 6 talks with a crewman of sister ship Gemini 7 and ground controllers as they accomplish the first rendezvous in space.
Ask them what their range is now.
Six, what's your range?
20 feet.
Roger. 20 feet, mate. We did it.
We did it. Later, safely down after a textbook Atlantic landing, Schirra calmly explained how he did it.
The first time we saw spacecraft 7 was at 54 miles slant range. This is when we started doing our work. And from there on, it was a case of maintaining very small rates as we closed, till finally we were, as Tom was quoted at least saying, at 120 feet sitting. His statement really was 120 feet steady. And this was our real proud moment. Seven was leading us in orbit in the attitude we call BEF, which is blunt end forward, and we were in the attitude of SEF, or small end forward. And this is the nose-to-nose routine, and as a result of this, we got our complete confidence up and did close to about 1 foot in this position.
Now that was the end of our busiest year in space. Pictures transmitted back across the 140 million miles between us and Mars. They showed a very thin atmosphere on the planet, but the old argument about the possibility of life on Mars was undiminished.
Jimmy 4, Houston, Cap Cobb.
Hey, Cobb, I don't know if you're ready, but we're right over Houston.
On June 3rd, Gemini 4 went into orbit.
Gemini 4?
Aboard were Major James A. McDivitt and Major Edward H. White. And on this flight, for the first time, an American, Major White, stepped out and floated in space. It took years and millions of dollars to put a man alone in space, and as it turned out, it was almost as hard to get him back.
Gemini 4, Houston?
I've only put the focus down to about eight feet or so. Jimmy 4, Houston. The flight director says get back in. Jim, got any message for us? Jimmy 4, get back in. Okay, I don't know, we're coming over the west area, I want you to come back in now. Roger, we've been trying to talk to you for a while here.
Now, back in. Come on.
We still got 3.5 more days to go, buddy. Okay.
Gemini 3, 4, and 5, like clockwork, 60 days apart. Then 7 and 6 in a dual flight, all manned, all successful. For the first time since October 1957 and the first Soviet Sputnik, the United States had reason to feel it was at least in the same space league with the Russians, and perhaps well in the lead. To listen to the voices of the astronauts was almost like listening to the future. Almost. For even in space, some vestiges of the past survive.
Gemini 7, this is Gemini 6. We have an object, looks like a satellite, going from north to south, probably in a polar orbit. He's in a very low trajectory, traveling from north to south.
A playful Wally Schirra, the rendezvous now a page in history, radios that he's in contact with a mysterious flying object near his Gemini 6 in the cold December skies.
Six.
This dark side of the world shows itself in its most abhorrent and dangerous form in Southeast Asia. There, the year is ending with war in Vietnam, a war more violent.
Jingle bells from outer space and a plea for peace from the United Nations. Human life and that was how man approached Christmas 1965.
More harmful relations among the great powers and more perilous to the whole world than at any other time during the generation of conflict which that country has known. This war must be stopped. In this place, let there be, in the words of the recent appeal by Pope Paul VI, an immediate truce, to be followed by reflection, negotiation, and finally, peace.
UN Secretary General U Thant was only one of a score of diplomats, mostly American, who embarked on an intensive peace offensive at year's end. President Johnson sent a team of American troubleshooters to Moscow, Rome, Paris, Belgrade, Ottawa, London, Tokyo, Manila, every possible capital where contacts, however tenuous, might be made with the leadership of the jungle enemy in Vietnam. But by the end of the year, there was no known contact, no audible answer to the American peace overtures beyond a repetition of the old charges of fraud and trickery.
And suddenly, almost, the year was running out. A young man named John Lindsay was elected mayor of New York, the first Republican to be elected in 20 years. Even before taking office, his troubles began. A man named Mike Quill, who heads the Transport Workers Union, wanted a new contract with more money and a shorter week.
We don't need the mayor to settle this. He made such an ass of himself yesterday over a period of 15 hours that between himself and John B. Oakes, and his little handy men who write the editorials for the New York Times, that the people of this city have a strike. They're right in the center of it now, and let them try to get out of it.
One more voice in the cacophony of voices of 1965.
Offered to the transit authority.
That's close to 293.32
and 2.95. Today, the world is facing a population crisis. In my judgment,
number four was play it being a homosexual. Number five, you can get a note from...
The men have a very important mission, to make the world safe for our pickets.
I'm opposed to violence! I'm opposed to...
Now here in Washington, we look forward with great pleasure to meeting...
Delivers 2-2 to Bob Allison. Swung on and missed. Allison is out. Pullback. Strikes out number 10.
Jamais plus les uns contre les autres. Jamais plus jamais.
Now, Frank, it looks like it comes out at the separation point. It might be the fiberglass, approximately.
Is our world gone? We say farewell. Is a new world coming? We welcome it. And we will bend it to the hopes of man.
Is our world gone? The answer, of course, must be yes. Old values challenged, old truths held up to the light and examined for weakness. Young people saying things that we never said and doing things that we never did. And as always in such times, the guidepost to the future was in the past. It is part of our glory that those who have left us leave their wisdom behind for all who must walk the new roads.
Nothing is final. Change is unceasing, and it is very likely that mankind has a lot more to learn before they come to their journey's end. We might even find ourselves in a few years moving along a broad, smooth causeway of peace and plenty, instead of roaming and peering round along the rim of hell. Thus we may, by patience, courage, and in orderly progression, reach someday, with God's blessing, the shelter of a calmer and kindlier age.